Hello, this is Androids and Assets. I'm your host, Olaf Rockney, and with me are my guests, Marshall. I'm doing that wrong.
No, you're doing it wrong, yeah.
Welcome to Androids and Assets. I'm one of your hosts, Marshall.
And I am Stephen, your other host. And with us is our guest, Dragonlance, scholar and critic.
Critic, more than scholar. I have read maybe 30% of all of the Dragonlance novels there are, and 8 or 9 of the role-playing supplements and assorted other media, played, I think, 4 or 5 of the video games through to completion. But, I mean, that is just what any kid of the 1980s who was kind of nerdy can probably say about Dragonlance. It was pretty ubiquitous.
That's fair.
At the time, I know there hasn't been a new Dragonlance novel in like a decade now, but when it was big, it was huge.
So before we get too far, we do like to provide proof for our listeners that we have an expert with us. So Olav, can you tell me who was the wizard or magician that Raistlin wanted his spellbook?
This man?
Fist and Intelis.
I'm sorry. It's been so long since I read those.
It's okay. It's okay.
I knew that one. I was so excited.
Continuing the long tradition of our guests not being able to answer our questions, we're just going to move on.
I'm embarrassed. I'm definitely embarrassed. I should say most of my knowledge of Dragonlance is centered around the Fourth Age, the Age of Despair. I guess we should, for the listeners,
we should talk about what Dragonlance is.
That's what it was.
So Dragonlance started as, I guess, a D&D setting. So it actually started as a series of modules in 1983, 1984, came out, I think, the first book, Dragons 84. Of Autumn Twilight is 84, but I think the modules are before that, a year or two before that. So
authors, of course, Margaret Wise and Tracy Hickman.
Wrote both the modules and the novels.
And partnered for a whole schwack of fantasy novels through the 80s and 90s. The Dark Sword trilogy, which is, in my opinion, the high point of their productivity. But also that Gates cycle, the 7-book thing in
yes.
the 90s.
They are still continuing to this day to partner and to write together.
But there are something like 180 Dragonlance novels at this point. There are a lot of Dragonlance mm-hmm. novels and like a dozen video games and 40 role-playing supplements and modules, and it is an enormous shared universe.
So we're not gonna do this in 25 minutes. We're not gonna do everything about it.
And we are sort of going to focus on the genesis of the series, which is the Chronicles trilogy, followed by the Legends trilogy, and it follows a pretty set core group of characters: Raistlin, Caramon, Flint, Tasselhoff, Tanis, Sturm, of course, Fitzban and Kitiana, and you know, it's the group of adventurers who have to fight off this massive evil army of dragons by crafting dragon lances, which are used to combat the evil dragons. It's the War of the Lance, which takes place in approximately the year 330. Post-cataclysm. And that cataclysm I bring up because it's an important part of the history of this world, that at the end of the Third Age, humans got so goddamned prideful that they brought down the wrath of the
gods.
World.
The gods hucked a big fireball at them, and one thing led to another, and the good gods all fucked off. Right?
And all the gods fucked off.
Good,
except
evil, mediocre.
For Tacasis, who yeah. broke her word.
Right.
Right.
You'd expect it.
It is a world that is in despair. It is the Age of Despair, as previously mentioned. There are no priests whose prayers are answered anymore. And
you can't play a cleric in this setting.
Yeah.
Unless you got the blue gem stick from the first one.
Right.
See,
I
read a lot of, I read some Wikipedia before this, so that's my contribution to this. We won't talk, I think, interminably about D&D as a game. But I think it is one of the most interesting things for me that came out of exploring this setting was the way that some of the mechanics, like the alignment system from D&D, got justified in with a kind of theological explanation. So like, the fact that there are good gods and evil gods and neutral gods, I think, was That made me chuckle.
Hard baked right into the
Got to put that mechanic right in there, and I think some of the racial characteristics also get narratively embedded, which is stuff that comes out of D&D.
Part of that world building is something I want to take issue with, and that is the currency system.
Currency in Kryn is really messed up compared to basically any other currency system that you read about. It's so off the wall from what the real world has experienced. It makes it feel quite alien. And I read Margaret Wise tried to say that she was trying to express the ephemeral nature of value, and that's why, of all things, steel was the base sort of currency.
Yeah, because she probably harbors Randian sympathies.
Bold claims based on currency.
I'm not going to cast aspersions towards Margaret Weiss or Tracy Hickman, two authors for whom I actually have some fair degree of respect.
Certainly. So, like a quick rundown. There's platinum, steel,
iron,
bronze, silver, gold, and copper. Sort of make up the. I think that's the human.
It's the standard currencies of Kryn, but there are slightly different variations on currency for different kingdoms, which makes a certain degree of sense. The Dragon Army values platinum most, followed by iron, followed by steel, followed by gold.
Wait, they value iron above steel?
Yeah, I know. Yeah, the Dragon Army had...
That's ridiculous.
Well,
yes and no, right? It all depends on the demand for it. If there's not a lot of iron around, you would think that steel becomes more valuable, but if all you're making is iron armor, then you don't want steel because steel might be too hard for you to work with, and you only want iron because iron is what you can work with. And then steel becomes less useful because iron is easier to work.
Yeah. Of course, the ancient kingdom of Zakhtsaroth used government-backed clay currency, where
fiat currency
it was an entirely fiat currency made out of clay, but they of course all died in the cataclysm because fiat currencies are evil and the gods punished the world for using fiat currencies. I'm making that up, but it's not too far from the truth.
So of course then the world, when they lose the empire that had a fiat currency that everyone could trust, they lose that empire, they lose trust in the currency. We've seen this plenty of times. And they move to a metalist system. Not completely irrational. You want something that has some inherent value that you can take to someone else who will also say, oh yeah, I see the value in that. I'll give you money for it. Or I'll give you goods for it. I'll trade you for that thing that you're carrying. That makes sense. I'm a little bit surprised that like local fiat currencies didn't ever develop, that they were all based on this metalist basic structure. But
so basically people stopped doing currency trading and adopted commodity trade.
Yes.
But here's where it gets sort of odd, that it's explained at one point that a person might buy a sword from a blacksmith, and they would pay the blacksmith 15 steel coins for that sword.
And then the
blacksmith would take like 8 of those coins and turn them into a new sword, keeping the remainder as profit, right? But the problem with this is that means your money supply is constantly shrinking, right? So it is not just like the gold standard in North America, where the failure of the currency system's money supply, the failure of that keeping up with the population caused price spikes in money and therefore depressions. You've got a money supply that is shrinking, and so your money is becoming more and more valuable over time due to scarcity.
Every time that you have a metal-based or any natural resource-based currency, it will be naturally deflationary. And for anybody who doesn't know, this is a learning moment. Deflationary is opposite of what we have of our currencies. We have inflationary currencies. Prices of goods always tend to rise. And officially, the definition is that your money becomes less valuable, so you have to pay more to get the same thing. So deflationary is the opposite, that your money becomes more valuable, and so you pay less. Prices should always be dropping in the world of Kryn, or with any deflationary currency. And we do see this in the real world. There's lots of deflationary examples that you can see prices that have to adjust to come down to match. Now, deflationary currencies have some inherent problems. You can get into spirals in where nobody will actually make any purchases because they're always expecting the price to be better tomorrow. And so deflationary currencies encourage hoarding of money, people to just hold on to the money, hoping that that money becomes more valuable the next day. Kryn should be like a hyper-deflationary currency, that it's not just that the population is growing and there's more demand for money and no better base. It's that the population is growing and you're actively taking money out of the economy. So it should be hyper-deflationary. If you have any steel, people don't want to ever spend it because it's going to be worth more and more and more.
And this is why it's the age of despair. Not because Tacnus is about in the world causing havoc and chaos because she's an evil chaos god. No, it's the age of despair because they have had 330 years of continual economic contraction. This is the depression to end all depressions. I mean, the Inn of the Last Home is the only business that seems to be open anywhere in the world anymore. And I blame these books. I blame these books for the Bitcoin craze of the present, because all of the kids who grew up in the 80s going, yeah, a metalist system is great. We should be using a medium of exchange that has real value, like steel. And now they are in their 40s, and they have decided to build a system like that with a deflationary currency that is Bitcoin.
Yeah, I was just about to point out those same parallels. It's a nice parallel to look at deflationary currencies in these worlds. And I think in some ways, yeah, people reading these books and reading them at a tender age, and an impressionable age, and saying, yeah, money should have an inherent value. And that makes sense. It's intuitive that, yes, what I'm spending with should be valuable to other people. And sometimes it's not intuitive that a fiat currency has value to other people or where that value comes from.
But one thing that they get right is that value is relational, right? Like, one of the reasons why steel is chosen as a coin system is that after the fall of Istar, during the Cataclysm, a lot of steel was taken out of the world, and gold is more common. In fact, gold is more common than silver in this world, so silver has a higher value. Steel is rarer, so steel has a higher value. In fact,
and yet it's their currency. And like, this is crazy.
One of the things about the currency that drives me a little bit crazy is that bronze is way overvalued compared to copper.
10 bronze to 500 copper. It's a 50 to 1 ratio.
Exactly. Yeah, you can have one bronze coin and get 50 copper coins. If you melt those copper coins down and add 5% zinc, you get bronze. And all of a sudden, unless zinc is incredibly rare in this world, you can create value in your currency. You can exchange a little bit of bronze, get a lot of copper, get a lot of bronze. Exchange a little bit of that bronze, get a lot of copper, get a lot of bronze. Any metalsmith should be able to become wealthy.
An incredibly wealthy bronze speculator. And maybe zinc is extremely rare. Yeah. That means they can't start their cars or kill themselves.
But, I mean, the value of steel being high is kind of interesting. And the fact that steel is almost a precious metal is interesting. I mean, because they didn't have enough steel, they had to make lances out of dragons, hence the name. No, did I misunderstand that about the books?
I think you missed something there.
Okay.
So we start, what I'm hearing is we're trying to see the signs that there are some conjecture hard-boiled into Kryn as a setting, and mainly, yeah, things about value, things about economic relationships between people, economic relationships between people and groups. Interestingly enough, I think there's dynamics of economic relationships between races. So there's ways in which these, again, kind of the Lord of the Rings, I think, is very heavily inspirational to.
Oh, yeah.
Yep. Like anything written in the 80s.
Yeah, yeah.
I have started to think that you cannot write a great fantasy novel without asking questions of race, class, gender, and economics. You can't do it without figuring out the economic relationships and who is paying whom. Like, it just doesn't
so let's put this magnifying glass to Dragonlance. Like, because from what I see, it's kind of like yeah, well, there's this savage, brutal, I mean, there's this sort of savage, we're talking about the post cataclysm, you have this savage kind of post-lapsarian society where humanity in its hubris has angered the gods, got fireballed, and now you have this brutalist, almost like kind of, you know, libertarian sort of world where, like, you know, the strong conquer and seize and build, and the weak are kind of either abused or are sheltered and
really the right
used.
Word.
Yeah. Because in front of me, it's a theological transgression. And I believe one of the writers of Dragonlance is religious, right? They're some sort of Christian.
Yep.
Like,
oh, yeah.
And one of them's, I don't know, LDS or something? I don't know. But anyway, yeah. So, like, and this is what we, before the show, we're talking about, like, when Dragonlance came out, that kind of, the rumors I've heard, and also from my kind of experience as being a Christian, but also trying to, you know, growing up Christian, is that kind of the satanic panic in the 80s kind of really hit D&D. D&D kind of became this emblematic thing of, like, a satanic force in the world and the corruption of the youth, kind of as an aftershock, I think, to the main, like, satanic ritual abuse narrative that was kind of blowing up.
Yeah.
Dragonlance is in some piece they were going to get some people, some religious people in there, and they were going to write something that was about good versus evil and something that, like, religious people could relate to, and it could kind of avoid a lot of the crazy that was lurking inside that guy Gygax's little coven was just brewing up at the time, and I find that very convincing, because you see that I really see that in Dragonlance, and the fact that it just seems to have this it's designed to be something that's palatable to Christians.
Yeah, but I think it's more than that.
Well, there's a lot of Christian right politics, I think, that kind of move forward with that, or a lot of, like, reactionary politics that are kind of baked into it. And I think we see that in, like, this notion of, well, money has to have true intrinsic value, and, you know, and there's good people and there's bad people. And, like, this is one of the things I'm really interested in, whenever you have, like, because you have, like, the Hero's Lance and then the throne, like, you have the gods divided into good, neutral, and evil. What concrete actions, what policy decisions separates, like, the Knights of the Lance from, or
Heroes of the Lance. Heroes they are Lance. Not one of them is a knight.
One of them
only
is a knight.
One of them.
Right. Let's
be very careful.
The Heroes of the Lance and the kingdoms they represent versus the Draconian versus
now,
the Dragon.
Okay. I think reading these things, yes, it's very easy to say there's these hard baked lines of there's good people and there's bad people. And definitely there are some bad people. Lord Soth is evil. Unequivocally, he is evil. He's also he's very one dimensional. In that he's just evil. But you get characters like Raistlin Majeer or Kitiara Uthmatar, who, by the end of the books, are both evil. Raistlin starts off his life as a white mage. Him and his brother Caramon are, like, just soldiers for hire. Caramon is a big, burly guy. He's, like, the typical barbarian. And Raistlin is the more wispy... Yeah. Often suffers from ill health, and he's the magician. But throughout the books, Raistlin desires more and more power, and he always compares himself to Caramon, who Caramon is always strong, always healthy, always seems on the outside very powerful. And Raistlin is always like, I want to be strong like Caramon is. And eventually that seeking power, he goes from being a white mage to being a red mage, and from a red mage to being a black mage. And so he sells his self for evil, to get the power that being evil presents. Because once you're evil, you don't have restrictions on what you can do. And so he doesn't, he's not evil because he just wants to do bad to people. He becomes evil as a means to an end.
Sure, but let me frame it differently. Like, okay, so the Heroes of the Lance, they're not really, they're a mercenary force. Like, they're just a collection of people doing a thing. But, like, but they have basically, they're trying to foil the Dragon Army, and the Dragon Army has a geopolitical agenda against, like, the Elf Kingdoms, per se. And so, like, when we break down, like, their actions and their policies, like, as far as we understand it, their policy positions and their conduct, and their kind of social composition. How are they different from, like, the Elf Kingdoms? And how is that, like, this is what I'm wondering. Like, what are the value judgments about good and evil societies then? Right, because there's definitely a lot of moral, like a lot of it boils down to, like, yeah, like, your intersubjective experience and how you relate to people, and that's what makes you a good or a bad person or whatever.
So, to answer that, I think earlier you said the Age of Despair is a very libertarian society. And maybe some of them are, and I think the Dragon Army is, but then you also do have the formation of the Knights of Solemnia, who say, you know what, we just want to do good.
And right, but who's funding them?
The Knights of Solemnia are a government system. They have a city. I can't remember the name, probably Solemnia. That's just how they named things. They are the government. So they had, like, ranks in the orders of knighthood. So there's, like, a Knight of the Rose, a Knight of the Crown, and a Knight of something else. I probably had the order wrong. Anyway, so there's, like, three ranks, and then one of the knights of the highest order was nominated by his brethren to be the head of the Knights of Solemnia, and so he governed the kingdom, well, not kingdom, the nation of Solemnia, and that nation was split into a feudal system that each knight controlled portions, and they worked together to make sure that their nation had order and some semblance of prosperity, that the people who lived there could be relatively sure that there wasn't crime and a government that they could turn to for redress.
So the thing that makes a good society in Dragonlance is law and order, a good environment for business and profitability, and robust military and defense.
Sure, yeah. But that's the same as any society anywhere.
Well, no, because those are particular sticking points.
Yes, that's probably the basis of most of their societies. But then they do expand on a few of them, and I don't want to get too much into it because you start getting into weird Dragonlance backwaters. But you can look at the Kaganesti, and you can look at some of the different elven societies that exist. I particularly enjoyed the Kaganesti story, the wild elves. But Dragonlance does suffer from sort of the after effects of fantasy racism that Tolkien set up, right?
Oh, don't get me started on the Gully Dwarves.
Dwarves are bad.
That's also ableist, I really feel.
Very, yeah,
like,
very.
A lot of, like, it's a... Yeah.
Yes, the Gully Dwarves, who somehow all of them were had developmental disorders. It's unfortunate that they were written as a species to be that way. Something that wouldn't happen now. And I'm betting. Well, I hope at least that a lot of people regret that decision.
They are right there in the 2008 movie, though. I am proud to say they are. I'm not proud.
Well, I mean, unfortunately, they have to be because Raceland's,
their,
like,
huge
sidekick was Boopoo Gulp.
Yeah. He charmed persons. Boopoo.
Yes.
And that's how they get into the castle.
And he charmed her, which is one thing. But eventually they do become friends, because when he's battling Fistan Dintilus for his soul, the one image that lets him win is his friend Boopoo.
Yeah, so it's okay to mentally dominate someone lesser than you as long as you become friends with them later.
I'm not saying it's okay. It's terrible.
It's really terrible.
And
that is, for me, the most egregious part of all of Dragonlance.
But I think, so the fantasy racism we're talking about, if you're not familiar with it, is that humans are a widely varied people. Some of them are tribal people who live nomadic lifestyles. Some of them are knights. Some of them are I don't know, syndicalist collectives of villages.
Wizards or whatever.
Some of them, they can become wizards. They can do anything, and they are widely varied. And then you've got the dwarves who all muck around in the ground digging for stuff. And you've got the elves who live in forests and live in harmony with nature in one way or another. And you've got the ogres who are evil and just bash stuff. And
gully dwarves who are dumb.
For an example of how this works, the Will Smith movie Bright.
Yes.
Yes. I mean, that is the fantasy racism taken to its logical extreme. And that's actually the best thing about the movie Bright.
The best thing about it is that it's super racist.
No, that
it takes it to its logical extreme.
That it points out the inherent racism of a bit of pop culture that's pretty widespread. I mean, everybody sort of gets the orcs are bad, elves are good, dwarves are gruff but trustworthy, and, all of these, racial stereotypes, and, like, never
it does wholesale transpose that into a contemporary social framework.
There's an elf. There's a lot of stories about him. He's quite famous in the stories. I can't remember his name now, but if you know them, you know him. He was an elven magician, and he sold his soul to become a dark mage and lived in society for a while, hiding this fact, and then eventually was found out and kicked out of society. But the elves were such that it was just a given that if you were a mage and you were an elf, you were a white mage. That's just how it was. There was no fathomable way that you would even be a neutral mage. You had to be a good mage because you're an elf. But humans, you never knew what they were going to be. It was like, oh, well, they could be anything. Like, it depends. They're humans, right?
It could
belong
to any alignment, or could be anything.
And if you were an orc or an ogre, you were probably one. You never became a mage because you didn't have the mental capacity for it. So you might be a sorcerer.
Well, and this is also where D&D
but
mechanics...
But you'd be evil.
Yeah, and certainly, so I think like D&D has proceduralized, and this is something I want to talk about D&D in a purer sense one day, but D&D really proceduralized this racism in the sense that orcs have a bonus to strength, but they take penalties in wisdom or int. Humans have a flexible bonus. The bonus can be applied, right? So they've really codified this racism, and I think this is one of those funny things where, well, if it's in D&D as a structure, you have to put it into your narrative. So this is I think one of the fun things about Dragonlance is the way that D&D rules get written into reality, the fabric of reality in these stories.
I was glad that in later stories, some people tried to explore having elves who were evil or finding ways to play to explore this racism. I don't think that they ever solved it because it was kind of hard baked into the initial structure of the world. And I think fantasy's gotten better with it recently. But yeah, fantasy racism is still
around. That's why some of the best fantasy really doesn't have other races. I'm thinking, Game of Thrones.
Yep.
You don't need elves or dwarves, well, other than the more prosaic form of dwarf. Gormenghast. Jonathan Strange and Mr. Norrell, I guess there are elves, but they're not really elves.
Yep. The magicians.
But anyway, all this to say, though, I was quite amazed reading about Dragonlance how much influential Dragonlance has been. It's in Warcraft, actually. I was amazed how much of Dragonlance is just like ripped out of Dragonlance and plugged into Warcraft. It's influenced, I think, a lot of subsequent things and a lot of subsequent settings.
I'm just going to throw this out there. The core six novels of Dragonlance are underrated in terms of fantasy today. They sort of get sneered at because they get lumped in with all of this bloat of the shared world that came after it. And so the books get seen as disposable literature that you can pick up for a dime at a used bookstore and thrown away. And all of the books look pretty much identical. Same basic logo, same, you know, framing on the front, same Larry Elsmore drawings. And it's really easy to confuse one for another. But if you are interested in Dragonlance today,
and you should be.
So, recommendation, only read Chronicles and Legends and then say, that's it, I understand what Dragonlance is all about, and move on to something else.
I can endorse that.
There you have it. That is your reading order for Dragonlance.
Okay, well, again, thank you, Olav, for sitting in with us this week.
Thank you for letting me vent about something that has been bothering me for about 30 years.
It's a long time to hold a grudge.
I have been angry about steel as a currency ever since I discovered why the gold standard didn't work.
ever since Bretton Woods, I've hated steel currency.
Well, I didn't find out that gold standard was a bad idea until probably 1990, but yeah.
I still had no opinions on it in 1990.
You still have no opinions on it?
Had. In 1990, okay. I had no opinions on it. Thanks for listening this week. You can find Androids and Assets on Google Play or iTunes. It would be really great if you could go on there, give us a rating and maybe some feedback. Leave a comment.
And listen in next week as they tackle the science fiction classic series, Supertrain.
That's not going to happen.
That is.
No, they're totally talking about Supertrain next week.
You can also find us on Twitter, at AssetDroid, and we'd love to hear any feedback you might have for us.